throughout my intro, and then I'll just pull up your microphone. So here we go. I'll be back.
Okay.
Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Is Dr. Michelle Cohen, and you are officially on the couch here on LA Talk Radio, as you always are, live Fridays on the country's most irreverent, entertaining, and cool radio station on the internet. Of course, it's around the world, folks, too, so you can always listen to me no matter where you're at. LA Talk Radio, and as always, I have a great subject for you. Things to think about. You know, I'm a psychologist, so I want you to think about self-awareness and some of the people around you who you may know or stories you may have heard. You're going to learn a lot today because we're talking about sexual addiction. Yeah, what is that, huh? Well, what do you do when you wake up one day to discover that your loved one, the one person who you're supposed to trust completely, what do you do when you find out that they've been living a life of lies and deceit? Because he or she suffers from a disease called sexual addiction. So finding out that the person you love is a sex addict is really tough. You know, I've had a lot of patients who tell me it's one of the most painful experiences that they've ever had. You know, it's hurt and betrayal, confusion and anger. And of course, that's the way we feel when we discover that about our partner. And today we're going to cover the subject of dealing with lots of things around that, especially recovering from heartbreak after learning about our partner's many sexual encounters. But also, my guest and I, who I will introduce in just a little bit, are going to help you understand the definition of sexual addiction and why people do it, some of the motivations, what's going on with that, and how to recognize the common behaviors of sexual addicts. Okay. So my special guest today, without further ado, let me bring her up, introduce her. She's Dr. Stephanie Carnes, and she's the president of the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals. She's a senior fellow for Meadows Behavioral Healthcare, where she works with sexually addicted clients and their families. Dr. Carnes is also the clinical architect for Willow House, a relationship healing for women struggling with sex, love, and intimacy disorders. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist and a certified sex addiction therapist. She's also the author of many publications, including her books, Mending a Shattered Heart, A Guide for Partners of Sex Addicts, and Facing Heartbreak, Steps to Recovery for Partners of Sex Addicts, and Facing Addiction, Starting Recovery from Alcohol and Drugs. Let's bring her up here live in the studios. Hi, Dr. Carnes. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for having me, Michelle.
Oh, it's so nice to, you know, finally meet you over the air in person here after reading your books. You're really an amazing, helpful person when it comes to this particular subject in terms of these books. I know you're an MFT and you do a whole lot of other work as well, but you are an expert when it comes to understanding sexual addiction. So, you know, thank you so much for your part in helping people, Stephanie. Really appreciate it. You know, I'm always interested in how people get started in their field of study, especially in psychology or helping people in therapy. So what was it that helped you get involved in helping people understand sexual addiction and in helping families and partners cope with a lot of those folks who have sexual addictions?
Sure. Well, I was actually exposed to the concept of sex addiction as a child. My father is one of the pioneers in the field and actually wrote some of the first books on it. His name is Dr. Patrick Carnes, and so he's been around the field for a long time and has, you know, was sort of the pioneer. He's a Fulbright scholar and has written, you know, probably about 15 books and 100 articles on the subject. So he's been in the field for a long time. And so when I went into psychology, you know, I actually decided to do something different for a while. I was in medical family therapy, and and over time he kind of worked on me and got me to work with him. We started doing research together and I got into the field of addiction. So I've been doing that with, you know, working with him and working in addictions for about 15 years now.
Wow.
So it's been a long journey.
That is a long journey, and bless your heart. I mean, that's wonderful to have your dad just sort of help you into that, you know, total field of, you know, which is rather scarce. I think a lot of people really don't understand sexual addiction and the concepts. And bless your dad. I mean, he's awesome. Patrick Carnes, I know who he is. Amazing.
Yeah, it's very misunderstood. You're right. It's still very stigmatized and misunderstood.
Gosh, it is. So can you define sexual addiction? Like, you know, whatever your definition
is? Sure, we did. Like a lay definition that we use is that it's a mood-altering, it's a pathological relationship to a mood-altering experience that's sexual in nature that the individual continues to engage in despite adverse consequences.
Wow.
So we look at things like people spending excessive amounts of time, people trying to stop their behavior that can't. We look for a pattern of compulsive behavior over time, you know, escalation and progression of the behavior to more intense, more frequent, more risky behaviors, you know, feelings of psychological distress when they can't access those behaviors. So, you know, those are the kind of things that we would look at when looking for sex addiction.
And so this is a medical diagnosis in the ICD-10 and also the DSM, right?
Well, actually, no, it's not. It's still been very controversial. It actually was at one point in the third revised edition of the DSM, there was a diagnosis called non-paraphilic sexual addiction. But that was removed, and there was a lot of concern that it might be used to get sex offenders off the hook in court cases and things like that at the time. And so there was a lot of controversy around it. So it was pulled out of there. And right now there still is no actual official diagnosis in the DSM. Now the ICD-11, the new draft, does, it's not approved yet, but the new draft proposal does include both the terminology sexual compulsivity and sexual addiction. But the DSM has not yet approved a diagnosis. So there's still a lot of controversy about what terminology is going to finally be included in the DSM. Some people say we should call it sexual compulsivity or hypersexual behavior or sex addiction or an impulse control disorder. So there's still a lot of controversy around what we're going to call it. But at this point, most people you know, agree on the general constellation of symptoms, and most of the research has a lot of consensus on the type of criteria that would be used to define sex addiction.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? You and I were talking about before we went on the air that, you know, there's a group of, as we call them, sexologists in the psychotherapeutic community that are saying that sex addiction is not a real disorder. And
Right. And there are some sexologists that absolutely agree that there is, but there is, you know, that this is a real thing, and try and educate and get the word out. But there are people in that community, and basically where that comes from is, you know, sexology has always had a long history of wanting to be very sex positive, and they don't want to pathologize anything sexual, so they've worked really hard to, you know, like do things like LGBTQ education and awareness and advocacy, and want people to feel positive and healthy with their sexuality. So there's a sort of a, you know, a lens there of not want to pathologize anything. So some people from, you know, with that background think that sex addiction is not real, that you can't have too much of it. And, but those, you know, it's a pretty small group at this point that are, you know, still putting that out there. Most people and most of the organizations in the field of sexual health actually agree this is a real disorder, but there's still a lot of controversy about what we're going to call it.
Right. It's so true. It absolutely. By the way, guys, in case you just logged in here, I'm talking to Dr. Stephanie Carnes. She's the president of the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals, a senior fellow for behavioral health care, and she's working with sexually addicted clients and their families. She holds a lot of offices, and there's a huge amount of accolades, but we're also going to be talking a little bit more about her books, Mending a Shattered Heart, A Guide for Partners of Sex Addicts, and Facing Heartbreak, Steps to Recovery for Partners of Sex Addicts. I'll also tell you how you can find out more about Dr. Carnes and pick up her books as well. And also, guys, if you want to email me some questions, that's cool. You can do so, and I can pass them along to Dr. Carnes, if that's cool with you, Stephanie.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll help some folks out here on the air, as we always do. And you can email me straight into the studio here, straighttalkdoc@gmail.com. That's straighttalkdoc@gmail.com if you have any questions about sexual addiction, or you have been diagnosed with that, or are a partner of someone who has that particular disorder. So let us know, folks. We're always here to help you out and answer your questions. This is Dr. Michelle, and you're on the couch with me on LA Talk Radio here. So what's so interesting to me, and you said, you know, they're still exploring the definition so it can be in the new ICD-11, the medical,
right,
you know, diagnosis journal. You were saying a little earlier that when you say that sexual addiction is really similar to chemical dependency. So what is that about?
Right. Actually, the neuroscience is very similar. Mm. So what we're starting, there's been a lot of research in the last, in particular, the last 2 years that has really blossomed in this area, fortunately. And so, for example, there's researchers in Europe that have been doing fMRI studies that demonstrate one of the things that happens when you have an addiction is your brain becomes, it's called sensitization. It becomes highly sensitized mm-hmm. to cues and triggers in your environment. So, for example, when a cocaine addict sees a line of cocaine, their brain responds very differently than a non-addict's brain. And so they actually have brain changes that occur in the dopamine system and in the reward center of the brain. And basically, over time, the dopamine system changes. You have hypofrontality, where the functioning in the frontal lobes decreases. And this is what we call the hijacked brain, which is the disease concept of addiction. And we're seeing the same thing in sex addiction.
Yes.
And so, for example, like Valerie Voon at the University of Cambridge, she put people at fMRI machines and showed them pornography.
Yes.
And had the same type of cue reactivity happening in the brain that happens with drug addicts and alcoholics.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we're starting to see a lot of, there's a convergence of research that is pointing all in the same direction. This is why the American Society of Addiction Medicine recently accepted what they call, they did their new definition of addiction, and they accepted behavioral addiction. Sometimes
yeah.
people call it process addictions
yeah.
Or natural addictions, which are things like gambling and food and sex and even video games. And that, because what we're seeing is a very similar response in the brain
right.
as we see with chemicals.
Yeah. That's amazing. You know, that's so interesting.
Yeah.
You know, when you get into the science and the neurobiology of what's going on, there really is a disorder. There's a chemical thing or a brain parts that really are not, you know, properly working.
Absolutely.
Or, yeah.
Absolutely. Really when you present a compulsive pornography user,
right,
an image of pornography, their brain absolutely lights up
yeah.
and responds in a completely different way than somebody that doesn't have that
yes.
behavior. And yeah. so they can't control that response.
Right.
Wow. So it's that's what makes it so hard for them. It, porn becomes so compelling, you know, when their brains are triggered with that. So.
Yeah, exactly. Wow, so interesting. So let's get into the nitty gritty here and find out so people can define exactly if they are with a sex addict or if they themselves are one here on LA Talk Radio. Can you kind of just talk about the common behaviors? You know, you talked about a lot of porn, viewing a lot of porn and stuff like that. So
sure,
what
sure.
are some of the most common behaviors of sex addicts?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely the most common ones are like pornography, prostitution, just like promiscuity and hookups and, multiple relationships. It sometimes gets a little dicey when you include people that have a lot of affairs or multiple relationships, because we also, you know, have the terminology relationship addiction or love addiction that sometimes gets is comorbid with sex addiction. So some
right.
people are also have a relational component to their behavior.
Right.
So those are by far the most common, but certainly it can escalate to things like voyeurism or
yeah.
exhibitionism
yeah.
and yeah, that type of thing. There is a small overlap with sex addiction and sex offending behaviors.
Okay.
But I want to emphasize that it is pretty small when you actually use the criteria for addiction to define it. Some of the research has shown that classifying sex at when you use the classification system in research that has been proposed, it doesn't actually classify a whole lot of sex offenders, but there is some overlap.
Yes.
So, and I want to be careful with that, because there's a lot of misunderstanding in the media. The media called the Craigslist killer a sex addict.
Right.
They called Fidel Castro that locked the women in his basement a sex addict.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not sex addiction.
Yeah.
So, there's just a lot of confusion around that. So mm-hmm. sex addiction doesn't mean pedophilia, and it doesn't mean antisocial behavior.
Yeah.
But sometimes you can have some antisocial behavior overlapping with the population, but it's a smaller percentage.
Oh, wow. That is really interesting. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So those are some of the common behaviors. And what are some of the signs that partners of sexual addicts usually pick up? You know, I mean, what are some of those things that we sort of go, things that make you go, wait a minute.
Sure.
I haven't heard from him or her all
so
day.
Typically what happens for 60 or 70% of partners, you have sort of two groups. You have a uh-huh. group that where the information comes out in drips and drabs over time. We call it staggered disclosure, or it's like a staggered discovery process where they'll first find out that, you know, maybe there was some strip clubs, or maybe there was some prostitution use, or that they're using a little porn or something like that.
Right.
They'll know a little bit about the behavior, but they won't know everything that's going on.
Sure.
Because a sex addict, they try to do damage control by not revealing all the information to the
right.
partner. And as their addiction escalates, over time, the partners start to make discoveries until there's sort of a realization that this is this is obviously more than just an affair, or this is obviously more than just, some strip clubs or whatever. This is like a pattern. So they start
right.
to, this group kind of puts it together as the information comes out mm-hmm. in drips and drabs. The
right.
other group is a group where that is kept totally in the dark. And this is usually a smaller group. Sometimes addicts can be very creative in the ways that they cover their tracks. I had a client once that he had a calendar of all the places he was going.
Right.
And a separate calendar he kept for all the places he told his wife he was going.
Oh my gosh.
Like, he was meticulous about covering up his tracks.
Yeah.
And she was totally in the dark.
Oh, wow.
You know, and so for that group, it's usually a little bit, you know, it's a little bit more traumatic. I mean, it's traumatic for both groups, don't get me wrong, to find this out over time. It's just different in different ways, traumatic in different ways. But that group is usually, you know, very shocked to find out. When they find out, they usually find out more, a lot of information at once, and there's a crisis or something like that.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, this staggered disclosure process that I'm talking about is extremely damaging for the coupleship, because the addict is saying, you know, I've told you everything. I've told you everything.
Right.
But then there's more that keeps on coming out. So the partner doesn't know what to believe.
Yes.
Over time.
Sure.
And so the trust is just destroyed in the relationship.
Oh, yeah. You know, what happens a lot of times, and you've heard this too, I know, Dr. Carnes, from a lot of, you know, partners, many women, you know, of sex addicts, after they've kind of discovered, you know, their husbands, you know, hooking up with other women and being online, looking at porn all day, things like that. And, you know, she keeps bringing it up and saying, what's going on? And, you know, a lot of the women take it really personally. Is it me? Am I too fat? Am I not pretty enough? And, you know, we always go there, right?
You know? Oh, absolutely. Yeah, we call it negative self-attribution.
Right.
And actually, a lot of times, it's very common when people are traumatized to do that. You see that with rape victims,
sure,
you know, that have been... rape is, you know, if I hadn't been walking in that alley, or if I had worn a longer skirt, or
right,
you know, they turn around and blame themselves.
Exactly.
And partners do the same thing. It's mm-hmm. you know, and it's never about them. This behavior would have escalated no matter what, because this is an addiction.
Right.
And so, you know, I really try to educate partners that, you know, they cannot blame themselves. They cannot, you know, internalize that.
Right. It would be like blaming yourself for your alcoholic spouse or partner, or blaming yourself
exactly.
for your partner who has bipolar disorder. You know, maybe I'm not happy enough or good enough or something like that.
Exactly.
And also what happens, I think, with partners is, and again, I don't mean to keep saying guys who are sex addicts, but the, you know, statistics show that more men are sex addicts than women. It's just the way it is.
Sure.
Sometimes what guys do also, you know, very clever, you know, I like the story about the two different calendars, one you show to your partner and the other, yeah, is they turn it against the woman, saying, you're just paranoid, and your anger and resentment is like, you know, you're a nagging, angry mommy. You know, you're just paranoid.
Right.
And it's like, so, and you think you're going crazy, right?
Right. We call that gaslighting. We actually
exactly.
have a term that we use for that. And it's sort of like the crazy-making turning of the tables that addicts do in when they're in denial around their addiction, to try and turn the table. So I'll share another story with you to illustrate.
Yes.
I had a couple that I worked with where the addict had had many, many affairs and got into recovery for a period of time, and they had been progressing very well, you know, had a couple years where the addict was doing great, the couple was doing better, and then the partner, they came back into therapy when the partner started suspecting that something was going on again. Mm-hmm. And so what she did was she started looking around and checking. And so she checked his cell phone, or she was starting to check his cell phone, and he found out she was checking, and he said, you are such a grudge holder. When are you going to let this go? You always, you know, you'll never let us heal from what happened. You hold on to everything. And then the very next morning, she found out that he was indeed having an affair.
Wow.
And so it's sort of like that, the sky is not blue.
Right.
You know, that's what we call it, gaslighting, because it's from that old movie, the black and white
exactly.
movie.
Exactly.
You know,
that's something
gaslight.
People should
like
get a hold of.
Crazy
too.
Making.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really, that's exactly what happens. By the way, guys, in case you just tuned in here, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle here on LA Talk Radio, and I'm talking to Dr. Stephanie Carnes. She is an expert and the president of the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals. She's a senior fellow for Meadows Behavioral Health Care. She works with sexually addicted clients and their families. A lot of accolades. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist, a certified sex addiction therapist, and also she's written several books and edited many, and I'm going to tell you how you can get a hold of those books as well at the end of the show and find out more about Dr. Carnes. So we're talking about sexual addiction, and you know, we've been covering the definition, clinical definition, actually, that you know, is very similar to some kind of substance abuse definition. And also what happens sometimes, what causes, you know, someone to become a sexual addict. This is what I'm really interested in because, you know, we have the chemical imbalance that you just talked about, the possibility of, you know, brain structures not working like the so-called normal person in those fMRIs, you know. But what about, you know, growing up? I mean, is there some kind of, you know, environmental pattern that happens to people who become sex addicts?
Yeah, there's environmental issues, and then it's also theorized that there's some genetic issues that are going on.
Right.
So right now, it's one of the things that my father is doing a Fulbright research study on genetics, and we're collecting saliva swabs from all the clients because there's thought to be perhaps a genetic predisposition, as there is with chemicals. And they're working on isolating some genes. So you might have a bit of a genetic predisposition coming to the table. And then the environment that you're raised in can also alter the course of that. One of the things that's very, you know, over the years you see consistently in the research is trauma.
Yeah.
And so individuals with high rates of childhood trauma, in particular sexual abuse, but also there's been studies about neglect and emotional abuse and all, or really all types of abuse, that's very common in the histories of individuals with sex addiction, and also attachment failure in childhood, just not that kind of warm, nurturing connection that children need to thrive.
Sure.
And so when you have trauma and abuse, you know, it kind of sets you up for, you know, feelings of shame and, you know, difficulty regulating your emotions. So people self-medicate over time, and sex is just one other tool used to self-medicate.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. So why is disclosure about having a sexual addiction different than telling your partner about having an affair, you know, or cheating on them? And also, I also wanted to kind of touch on how much information should sexual addicts reveal to their partners about their behaviors and experiences? Because it's a,
Important area to me, because I actually just finished a research study looking at disclosure and what makes it more effective and, you know, least traumatic to partners as possible. So it can, you know, some of the research has shown that when addicts, you know, do disclosure and share information about their addiction to partners, that partners actually, 71% of them actually show PTSD symptoms and symptoms of acute stress disorder.
Right.
So it can be very difficult and traumatic. And we oftentimes don't think about the emotional repercussions of betrayal trauma, which is what the partner is going through.
Right.
But it's very significant, and partners need their own support as they go through that process.
Mm-hmm.
So I think how it's different from affairs is usually in the quantity of information.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, certainly, you know, people that have experienced infidelity certainly have an experience of betrayal trauma as well.
Right.
But with sex addiction, what you often have is, you know, a mountain of information that the partner doesn't know.
Right.
And so that can be really traumatic, depending on the content of that information, how much you know, how long the deception's been going on, how much information they didn't know about, if there's anything, if it ever progressed to something, you know, more unusual or deviant, you know. I mean, it can just be like a huge amount of information, and that's really hard for a partner to take and understand all at once.
Right.
And so, yeah, so usually what we recommend, we absolutely do recommend once, if you have a committed couple that is working, you know, you have an addict that gets into recovery, embraces recovery, and wants to save their marriage, and the partner's on, you know, on board with that, we recommend that both parties get supported and have their own therapist. And I do trainings all over the country,
right,
for certified sex addiction therapists,
sex
addiction therapists. So that, and I train them how to do disclosures in this way that would be least traumatic to the partners, which means it's they share factual, clear information that doesn't leave the partner guessing,
mm-hmm.
but also doesn't contain unnecessary details.
Yeah.
That, you know, just, you know, are very painful for the partner to hear.
Right.
And so they share that information in an environment where both parties have a therapist present, mm-hmm. and the partner is supported and has a
right.
plan of self-care for the week and multiple follow-up sessions where he or she can share her feelings with the addict and process that. So it should be a very supported mm-hmm. Process that they go through, and the partner, sure. you know, should be allowed to ask questions and all of that. So it's part of the healing process for the couple. It allows the addict to get honest about what's been going on, and mm-hmm. that's, you know, good for them in their recovery. And it also empowers the partner with the truth.
Yeah.
And gives the partner the ability to make healthy choices based on the truth.
Exactly.
And so, yeah. And then for the couple, it actually is a truthful experience. So it often, even though it's very painful and sometimes can, you know, set people back a ways, it actually also can create some hope for people, because now they know what they're dealing with, and they have a plan and they're moving forward. So if you want to actually get past it, and, you know, so that the addict can, you know, do what we call emotional restitution, which is like really try and, you know, support the partner and get, you know, let them know that they understand how much they hurt them, and, you know, take all accountability and be fully responsible,
mm-hmm.
then oftentimes you can really save relationships.
See,
and so it's, you know, there is a path for healing for couples with this,
yes.
If they get the right help and support.
That's amazing, you know, because a lot of, I know in my experience, a lot of patients, you know, the mates, partners, spouses, whatever, of those who are sexual addicts, they pretty much, they give up because they can't handle the, you know, the journey. You know, it's, again, it's like being on a journey with a substance abuser, you know, the relapse again and back
Absolutely.
And forth.
Absolutely.
You know, it's really
tough. It's so hard. And what the partners really need is they need to see the addict embracing recovery mm-hmm. and being honest and accountable. And when they see that, they usually have enough hope to continue in the relationship.
Right.
It's similar with chemical dependency. You have to have, you know, when family members have been, you know, lied to and stolen from and, you know, brought through the ringer with somebody's drug addiction, they need mm-hmm. to see somebody get really honest and accountable and really embrace recovery before they can reinvest in that relationship.
Right, right.
So, yeah, I often tell the couples that I work with is the only way to restore trust is reliable behavior over time.
Mm-hmm.
The only way. And
yes.
so you have to, you know, show up and be open and be where you say you're going to be. And,
yeah.
You know, and it just takes a long time to restore that.
Exactly. I had a really great question that came in here on straighttalkdoc@gmail.com from a listener. And gosh, this is a great question. It's really valid. It's from Brandy, and she says, do you think a lot of Hollywood male stars who come out as sex addicts, such as Michael Douglas, Jesse James. Oh, yeah, that was Sandra Bullock's guy, huh? Tiger Woods. Mm-hmm. Some of the other stars who have come out as sex addicts, do you think this is an excuse for them to play around, or do they really have addiction issues? That's a really good question.
Well, yeah, it's a good question. Not having met any of them, it would be hard for me. You know, we recommend a very thorough clinical evaluation that includes testing. We have NORMS instruments for this that help determine whether someone really is, you know, qualifies or doesn't, because, you know, it is tempting to, you know, people often overdiagnose, you know, a couple of affairs, and it's much easier to be a sex addict what have you. Now, that being said, I will say that there is definitely a subgroup, and it's even been in the literature. My father Patrick did a study on it, of people in positions of power. You see oftentimes there's a pattern in sex addiction where you have, you know, like the clergyman having sex with the parishioners, the doctors and the patients, the teacher and the student, the very famous football player and the vulnerable woman, you know what I mean?
Right.
When power, there is definitely a dynamic and a common behavior pattern that we see with sex addicts where it's the exploitation of power differential.
Yes.
And so when you have that, I have certainly seen sex addicts where that's their main issue, where they're, they use that power for seduction and have had, you know, definitely would meet the criteria for sex addiction.
Wow. So many. Charlie Sheen, Eric Benet, Nicole Narayan. And that's, you know, the females. There's a lot of females who've come out, too, who are in the, you know, high-profile media who said, yeah, I'm a sex addict. That's why you read all this gossip and, you know, stuff about me. So thank you, Brandy, for emailing us here at straighttalkdoc@gmail.com on LA Talk Radio. You're on the couch live here with Dr. Michelle. And my special guest today is Dr. Stephanie Carnes. We're talking about sexual addiction. She has several books out. We're going to tell you how to get a hold of those in just a little bit. But she is a professional, the president of the International Institute for Trauma and Addiction Professionals, just to name a few, many accolades and, you know, expertise training that she has. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist and a certified sex addiction therapist. It's very difficult work as well because it's a very touchy subject. You know, you have to really walk carefully with the victims and also with the individuals who are diagnosed with this because, you know, it's really understanding on both parts, and particularly with the partner who is the victim, you know, understanding that this is a disease, this is a disorder, and can you hang with this? Education, you know, can you understand that if you really walk through the steps and your partner is willing to get help? Is this relationship as important for you to do that? So there's so many different things to think about. I'm trying to think also there's really things to help, you know, the sexual addicted person. And they're just really a lot of programs out there. Like there's 12-step programs, right, Stephanie? There are
absolutely. There's tremendous resources for people that are struggling with. There's four different fellowships: Sex Addicts Anonymous, Sexual Compulsives Anonymous, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, and Sexaholics Anonymous.
Right.
So four different fellowships, and there's fellowships for the partners as well. There's a lot of treatment facilities, probably about 10 that specialize in this area all over the country. There's, I think there's 1,800 certified sex addiction therapists now across the internationally. So most of those are in the United States. So, if you can actually usually find one by your zip code. So if it's something that you're, I can give you the website. It's sexhelp.com, www.sexhelp.com.
Right.
And you can search for a certified sex addiction therapist via your zip code. Mm-hmm. So if people need resources, and there's so many books, there's tremendous books for addicts. And now it used to be that we didn't have very much information for partners, but now we have, you can find on the website therapists that specialize with the partners, a lot of materials for the partners, a lot of support groups for the partners. So we've come a long way with this, especially in the last, 10 years.
We sure have. It's really good, and it's helpful, and a lot of people, again, suffering. I was just reading American Marriage and Family magazine. They said that over 12 million people in the United States are clinically diagnosed with sexual addiction. So that's that's a pretty staggering number.
It's very common.
Right.
It's interesting because with the increased availability of the internet, we're seeing a huge increase in sex addiction and pornography addiction. And you have that with the other addictions too. In places where there's more casinos, you have more problem gambling. In places where you have more bars, you have more alcoholism. Mm-hmm. When there's meth labs that pop up, you have more meth addiction. Now we have the internet that has exploded everywhere. And we're starting to see, sex addiction is presenting all the time in people's offices clinically.
Yeah, that's a really good thing. So you talk in your books about the six stages of recovery for couples who decide to stay together, after everything is said and done, and there's, you got to work through these things. You've got to recover together many times. And I also, always encourage people to get individual therapy as well. So what are those stages for the couples who decide to stay together? What do they have to go through to try to make that relationship work?
Sure. It's actually the six stages for the partner that the partner experiences.
Oh.
So he or she actually goes through a process. We call it the developing stage where they don't. It's prior to realizing it's an addiction. And this is where the staggered disclosure process is typically happening, where they're starting to find out more information, and they're usually, the addict is usually lying to them, but they have a gut feeling that something's not right.
Right.
And they're struggling to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. Then there's a crisis in which the partner typically recognizes, whoa, this is not just a one-time thing. This is a pattern.
Yeah.
This is becoming a big issue. I'm not okay with this. And then the third stage is going into sort of a sense of shock around all of that.
Yes.
And so for a lot of partners, it can be, partners usually try to be strong, and they try, they're very resourceful, and they want the addict to get help. And they look for resources. They seek a lot of information. That's very common.
Yes.
During the shock stage, they might throw themselves into their work, or they might self-medicate themselves. They might kind of feel a little numb about it all.
Right.
They might be really suspicious or very emotionally distraught or very angry at the addict. Right. Usually. Rightfully so, because of the behavior. There's a lot of anger during that stage, and just a lot of distrust, going on in the coupleship. So usually at that point, the coupleship is very distressed.
Right.
So then, the fourth stage for partners is like a grief stage, because all of the losses that the addict is experiencing, oftentimes they'll have, in their addiction, if it's escalated, they'll have financial losses, job losses, relationship losses.
Yeah.
Their kids might find out. They might have public embarrassment, a lot of different things. And usually the partner is wrestling with all of that, too.
Right.
That's going on. And that's very hard for them. They have to kind of grieve what they thought their relationship was and deal with their losses and kind of cope with all of that, manage the distress of that.
Yeah, exactly.
The fifth stage is usually repair. And so obviously for some partners, they may choose not to stay. And so repair for them looks like, getting stronger, moving out of the relationship. And for others, it's, embracing the recovery process that I talked about earlier as a couple, getting the addict into recovery and doing a couple's healing process.
Right.
And then the last stage is typically growth. And we kind of think of growth as kind of like where they're focusing on a lot of issues that aren't related to the addiction. They kind of can even look back on the addiction, look at what positive things that might have come into their, like if we hadn't gone through this, we would have never gotten closer as a couple, or I would have, I wasn't happy in that relationship and now I moved on. And so we kind of can look at some of the positives.
that came out of it for them.
Exactly. Yeah. That's, you know, and that is, that's, those are great stages of just kind of getting through and working through and understanding that it is kind of a bumpy journey and that, you know, you will experience all these things. And, you know, you were talking also about, you mentioned kids. So when there's a family involved, Dr. Carnes, should the children be told or should couples try to protect them from knowing that, you know, one of their parents is a sexual addict?
Yeah, that's a really challenging question to answer in just a few minutes. I'll tell you some of the things that we consider.
Okay.
So a lot of times it's not an option. So unfortunately, there are situations, not, I wouldn't say a lot of times, but there are a percentage of times where the kids already know or have found out, made discoveries themselves, come across information. Mm-hmm. Kids are very smart and savvy enough to know what's going on in the home. And, or, you know, daddy's going to be on the 6 o'clock news they're going to find out from some other way.
Right.
And so in those situations, we call that a forced disclosure situation to a child where you really have no choice but to, you know, share information with the child to explain what they already know and help them understand that.
No, exactly.
So you also have situations where it may be appropriate to do what we call a softened disclosure to a child, which is where they might know something, and so you have to explain it. So, like, I had a client where the child came across his pornography stash. And so, you know, it was a small, a younger child. And so it was, you know, daddy was looking at people without their clothes on the internet.
Yeah.
This is not part of daddy's value system.
Right.
And, you know, so now we're going to put protection on the internet. So that, you know, taking responsibility for what happened specifically.
Yeah.
Or, you know, another example, I had a colleague, she's a female sex addict, and she had an affair with one of her children's friend's father.
Mm-hmm.
And so for her, and the kids found out about it.
Yes.
And so she said to them, you know, mommy had a boyfriend. Mommy's not supposed to have a boyfriend. Daddy's supposed to be mommy's only boyfriend.
Yeah.
So this is, we're not divorcing. We're working on it, you know, that kind of thing. So it was, you know, a softened disclosure is you try and protect the child, and you only give them age-appropriate information.
Right.
Right? Exactly. So, and then sometimes you have times when it might be appropriate to share information with an older child.
Right.
Like, for example, let's say you have like a case where a 16-year-old boy was using porn on their computer and the father's in recovery.
Right.
Well, the father might approach the boy and say, you know, I've got to share something with you. I've been in recovery for this, and this is something I've struggled with. And, you know, so it kind of helped prevent the perpetuation of the addiction cycle.
Exactly.
Over time. So we really want to, you have to balance good boundaries and good parenting and trying to protect the child with also giving them facts that help them make sense of the situation.
Sure. That's a brilliant explanation, Dr. Carnes. Beautiful. Listen, we're just about out of time here, but I want to make sure the listeners can find out how to learn more about you, your services, and, of course, where can they get your books? The books are Mending a Shattered Heart, A Guide for Partners of Sex Addicts and Facing Heartbreak, Steps to Recovery for Partners of Sex Addicts, and Facing Addiction, Starting Recovery from Alcohol and Drugs. So what's the best way, Stephanie?
Sure, yeah. So they can look for, if they're looking for a therapist or want some resources, like if they're wondering if they are a sex addict or if they're a partner, the best website to go to would be sexhelp.com.
Okay.
Or if they're looking for treatment, they can look up The Meadows in Wickenburg, Arizona. We have excellent programs there.
Great.
And
that's
learn about those.
So what website can folks get your book from?
It's easiest just to get it off of Amazon.
Okay.
There they can pull up Mending a Shattered Heart, Facing Heartbreak. They're easy to find on Amazon.
Perfect. Well, there you go. So thank you so much, Dr. Stephanie Carnes, for being a guest here
on
the couch.
Thank you, Dr. Michelle.
You're amazing, and I really appreciate all the work you do to help others really well.
Thank you.
All right. Take good care. We'll be in touch, and much appreciation again.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now. All right, guys, as you always know, that this show will be up in the archives for replay and download right now. I'll have all the archives information about how you can get Stephanie's books as well. And all of my shows are for free on iTunes podcasts as well. It's called On the Couch. Thanks for listening. As always, love to have you all out there. Appreciate it. If you have any questions or comments about today's show, you can email me, straighttalkdoc@gmail.com. So next week, what I'm going to do is answer a lot of listeners' questions. All right? It's one of those days. It's a free-for-all Friday. So I'm going to be helping you with relationship issues, personal self-esteem stuff, and some sexual addiction issues as well. So thanks for writing in, everybody. I appreciate it. Have a beautiful week, and I'll talk to you Friday. It's Dr. Michelle. Bye-bye.
Got you on my mind again tonight. Flashing.